Good morning. So I'm going to start off by picking up where Samira left off with this move to register CPU. So we have three instructions here, three different kinds of moves where the destination is a register every time. And we're going to make a processor which does all of these. And we'll start off by implementing our move queue, which takes reads a value from a register, which we do by taking something from the instruction memory, finding the bits of what comes out of the instruction memory which correspond to the first register number, sending it into the register file, getting out the value and putting it back into the register file, and at the same time, finding the bits that correspond to the destination register number and putting that into the destination input of the register file. And I have this mux here because I know, well, I'm going to need to make some choices in a bit where that's not always what I want to do. So I'm going to add that later. When you're implementing instructions generally, my recommendation is go instruction by instruction. And as you find out, oh, I have multiple choices here, add muxes. So I've done it a little early, but you might do it sort of, you might just first hard code to only do R remove Q and then say, oh, I'm going to need to have some other input to that and then add this mux. So next I have IR remove Q. For IR remove Q, it's the same as RR remove Q. We have the same destination, the same, so we can reuse all that logic from RR remove Q. The only thing which is different is what value we actually send to the register file. So we have this mux I just added, and we set as another input to the mux the value from the instruction. And we have to somehow have this piece of circuitry here, which we'll sort of have mostly built for us. But this is something which is going to look at the opcode, and it's going to send the appropriate signals to the mux. So if the mux getting 0 means it sends in the top wire, it's going to send a 0 whenever the opcode is the one for R remove Q. It's going to send a 1 whenever the opcode is the one for I remove Q, and so on. And last, we have the most complicated of these instructions, which is MR move Q. And we need to do two things for this. So most notably, we need to actually read the value from memory and send its output to this mux, because that's a different input to the register file. And the value we read is RB, which we now need, plus the immediate, which we conveniently already have on a wire that I'm just going to send to this addition operation, which is implemented by our ALU in the design the textbook chose, and send that to our address input. And not shown here, but we'd have to do it, is we have the read select input to the data memory is going to be set to 1 somehow. We'll talk later about how that actually happens. Presumably there's a mux that somehow gets fed from the opcode. So we read that, have this mux, and if you look carefully at the mRemoveQ instruction, it takes writes to RA, not RB. The justification for doing this is that this means every time we compute an address to send to the data memory, it's always D plus RB's value, not D plus RA's value ever. But doing that means that as a compromise, we sometimes have to write to RA. So we have to have this logic where sometimes we take RB, sometimes we take RA and send that to the register file. And we need a mux to do that, and part of this circuitry needs to be, in addition to choosing 0 for RR, 1 for IR, and so on, we need to choose 0 for everything but MRMoveQ and 1 for MRMoveQ. So we'll have some circuit which does that. So any questions about any part of this so far before I get to the PC part, which is, I think, straightforward? Okay. So finally, we have to deal with the PC. This is the same thing talked about before with like jump and nop. We have two choices. In this case, our choices are just both the current PC plus a value, but RR move Q, we have 2 bytes here. Everything else, we have 10 bytes, because our V and D are always 8 bytes. So we have to choose between those two, and that's another thing we're going to do based on the opcode. So we're going to have some circuitry here which looks at the opcode and sends a 0 if it's ARM of Q and a 1 otherwise in this case. And that's our complete processor, which only does moves to registers. And so later on, mostly on Thursday, with Samira, we'll go over adding all the other instructions to this. But this is our general process. We look at our instructions that we have to do, and one way of going about it is you just do one by one, and every time you need to make a choice, like one example was we needed to sometimes write to one register and sometimes another, you just add a mux and have that mux have a selection be made based on typically the opcode. So today I'm going to spend most of my time not talking about building our processor in this sort of way, but about how we're going to actually represent processors in a programming language of sorts. So far, when I've talked about processors, I've shown you pictures. You know, if I wanted to have a circuit which is a counter, so here we have a register, it outputs a value, it takes in the next value it's going to have, which is that value plus 1, so this counts up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 every time we have a clock cycle. So we have our clock signal, which we don't show on this picture, which is looks like this. This is sort of our voltage. And every rising edge of the clock signal, we have a count goes from 1 to 2 to 3 and so on. So this is a way of representing that. And we could just represent all our circuits with pictures like this. No. And you can figure out what goes on as, you know, clock signals, but that's actually pretty atypical. And notably, when we represent circuits, we just don't just want to tell you what does the circuit do and have you understand that. You know, in the real world, you want to actually build these circuits. You want to have a description of a processor and have someone actually build it. And pictures do a remarkably poor job at doing that and are remarkably annoying. You know, what if we need to add a component? We have to move everything. So some people do design processors and circuits with tools where we're just drawing pictures. This is sometimes called schematic capture because we have a schematic of a circuit and the tool captures it. If some of you took DLD here, that course sometimes uses a schematic capture tool called Logisim. That's not what we'll be doing in this course. This is not commonly what people do when they design processors. They want something that's more convenient and also allows them to have a higher level of abstraction. And so we're going to use something that's in a category of things known as hardware description language. You can think of this as a programming language, but instead of compiling to assembly and machine code, we're going to compile to a description of hardware that someone can actually build. So it's a programming language, but it compiles to hardware. So we're going to start with a text-based representation of a circuit. And in the real world, we'd have some programming language like this with a text-based representation, and we'd get out a set of instructions which said something like, okay, put this transistor here, put this transistor here, put this transistor here, wire them together like so, from our compiler for this language. And like real versions of these tools, we'll abstract away many details for the compiler to deal with. So in this class, our language and compiler and its libraries are going to deal with, like, how do you build arithmetic? We're generally going to assume that that's provided for us, that there's some pre-built arithmetic operation, and we just do arithmetic, and the tool chain is going to figure out how to do this. In the real world, this often happens too. Like, probably you don't just write it like arithmetic, but there's some library where someone made an adder for you. You don't need to write one. They just made it, you just pluck it in, and you put in this tool, and that gets compiled down to transistors eventually with this pre-built adder library. We're not going to worry about building registers from transistors. We're just going to say, I want a register, and our tool's going to figure out how to make that. We aren't going to worry about building memories. We're just going to say, I want a memory of here. I'm going to use my memory. It's going to work. We also aren't going to worry about building muxes. We're just going to say, here, I want a mux that makes these choices, and that's going to happen. So we're going to avoid these details, and the main way we're going to avoid them is that the programming language we're going to use to build hardware is going to have these as sort of abstractions like functions in a normal programming language that we can just call, just use, and the details are not something that we as a program writer need to deal with. So any questions about the sort of idea of the abstractions we have? Yes?
What figures out the spatial layout of what eventually gets built?
So the question is, in the real versions of this, what figures out the spatial layout? That is a very complicated process that is notoriously difficult for programs to actually do. But generally, there's something which tries to place the circuit physically, depending on what you're building it out of, that tries to do it automatically and does an okay job. And sometimes it's fixed up later by hand, or sometimes you add annotations to say, place this here, or something like that in the real world. The actual algorithms for doing that, if you've taken algorithms classes, for almost any version of how do I optimally place this circuit is NP-hard. So, they're not doing the best job. So, in this class, we're going to use an educational tool, which is code word for doesn't support things you'd actually want in the real world. So a tool that's built for this course. So our textbook talks about an HCL tool that they built. We have a slightly different version, which hopefully is more usable and has nicer features and exposes more to you. But this is built specifically for this course. It assumes you're making a processor. In fact, it specifically assumes you're making a y86 processor. So it has some things which are hard-coded in there that only really make sense in a y86 processor. It's somewhat different than the book's HCL. I'll talk about those differences today. The biggest difference is that in the textbook, they kind of assume that a lot of things are more fixed. Here you have more flexibility, but there's some other little syntax differences and things like that. So I'll start by showing an example of a very, very simple CPU, even simpler than I think any of the ones Samira showed you last time. And that's this CPU. The CPU runs NOP instructions and nothing else. So we have here an instruction memory and a PC register, which I'm calling the PC. And we add one. This blue blocks are generally going to represent some circuitry that performs a logical or arithmetic operation. So it adds one. That's the input to the register. So every clock cycle, we have a rising edge of the clock in the clock signal that we just don't show on this picture, but there's this clock signal sent to all the components that make them do things at the same time. At every rising edge of the clock, the PC changes, and the instruction memory has a new input, and it outputs something, and since we only support NOP instructions, we just always assume it's a NOP. So we don't even read the output. So one notable thing about how our tool assumes you're building a processor is that this instruction memory component is mandatory. You have to use it. So that's why I have it in this picture. We have to have our instruction memory because our tool just assumes we're always building a processor. A real tool obviously wouldn't do that because sometimes you build other kinds of circuits. So first thing we need is we need this register here. And we're going to have a way, as I mentioned, to say, I want a register. And this is what, in our HCL language, a register declaration is going to look like. So we have several different parts. So the first notable thing is I have this keyword register, okay, that makes sense, and then I have P, lowercase p, capital F. What does that mean? So those are names for the inputs and outputs of our register. So the lowercase p corresponds to the input, the uppercase F corresponds to the output. And the rule is that the first letter must always be lowercase, the second letter must always be uppercase. And to do an operation on that, we're going to say p underscore vpc is our input here, the input side, the p side, equals capital F underscore vpc plus 1. That represents the add 1 box and this connection. So we take the name in here, we add the input prefix for this input signal, the thing that will happen on the next clock cycle, and we add the output prefix for the output signal, the current value of the register. It's coming out of the register. So we also have, notably, this equals 0 here. That's the initial value of the register. It's not the value it's going to have all the time. It's the value it's going to have when our processor first starts. We have to specify that for every register because we want everything in a well-defined state when our processor starts. So the second thing we need to do is use the instruction memory. I told you this is mandatory because our tool assumes we're building a processor. So you'll get an error if you don't put an input signal into the instruction memory. It's always there. It needs an input or else it doesn't know what to do. So its input and output have two fixed names, which are just chosen for you. These match the names in the textbook. So the name of the input is PC. This is not necessarily a register. In fact, it's not one of the signals associated with our register. This is the input to the instruction memory, which is the address to read from. And there's an output signal, which we don't use in this case, called i10 bytes. So i10 bytes, it's so called because we always read 10 bytes. Why 10 bytes? Because our biggest instruction is 10 bytes. So we just always read the maximum we might need. Sometimes we don't use all the bytes. That's fine. So in this case, I'm setting the PC to be the value of my register. It's another connection for my the PC register. And there's an i10 byte signal that's produced, but I'm not using it. So these equal signs here represent a wire connection. Is the way you should think about it. We take the value and connect it to the other side. So this is almost the whole CPU, but if you try to run this in HCL, you won't actually get it to work. It will give you an error because we're missing one other mandatory component. So I told you the instruction memory is mandatory. There's another thing which is mandatory, again, from the assumption we're building a processor. And also because this is designed for a simulation where we're going to run it for some number of cycles and then stop. So we have this other mandatory component called the stat register. So this is a built-in register. You don't declare it. And it takes in a signal, which is actually a number. In this case, there's a built-in constant called stat AOK, which is just a number that's pre-declared for you, which indicates continue. There's another possible value, which is stat underscore HLT, which means stop. And when you run your processor, we're going to run it in a simulation, which is going to look at this stat register and use that to decide when the simulation keeps going. So as long as the stat is stat AOK, it's going to run for another cycle. If the stat is stat halt, it's going to stop. And it's going to print out, here's the values of all the registers, here's what happened when you ran this first cycle. You can think of setting it to stat halt being equivalent to telling the hardware, shut me down, or something like that. But it's not, we know this is not how it would work with real hardware, it'd be something more involved, but because it's intended for simulation, this is what we're going to use. And you have to set that signal, otherwise you'll get an error because the simulator doesn't know, do I keep going, do I not? It needs to have a value. So this is a complete valid HCL file that we can run with the tool that you will in fact use in lab on Wednesday. So to actually run this, we're going to need to have something to load into this instruction memory. So we're making a processor. Since we assume we're making a processor, you have to have a program to run. So we have to have a program to run. And the way we supply programs is with a file with the extension .yo. which sort of comes from Y86 object file, though it's not really an object file. It's like more like an executable file. It actually contains the entire contents of the instruction memory. And with the HCLRS distribution you'll download, there's a program called YAS that will convert a .ys file. That's a Y86 assembly file, so you probably know what that looks like. It's the assembly language we talked about when we talked about the Y86 instruction set, to a .yo file. And then you use that .yo file to run this memory image in your processor, to load it in the instruction memory, and then simulate the processor one cycle at a time. There's also a tool called YIS, which is a reference implementation of the processor written in C, which you can use to find out what is Y86 supposed to do for this instruction, which you might be helpful for figuring out whether you've actually implemented a Y86 processor or some other kind of processor. In the case of this, this is some other kind of processor. Yeah. It won't run any interesting Y86 program correctly. Okay. So let's look at a actual running this. So here I have what you'd get if you downloaded htrls.tar. And first thing I'm going to do is run make to actually build everything, including Y86. And I have pre-written here, I have that .cpu as a .hcl file. So I need a file to run it on, so I have a Y86 assembly file with some nops. So there's two ways I can convert this into a .yo file. One option is I can run make and change the ys to .yo, and that runs that the command shown there, tools ys on nops.ys. So that produces a .yo file, and the .yo files are actually readable. So the format of them, unlike object files and executables, they've decided to write things out in hexadecimal just to make it easy to debug. So you can see that this says there's a address 0, there's the hex 10 is the value of that byte, address 1, hex 10 is, so you can figure out very easily what's in this file. So then I'm going to run HCLRS in this. So if you're doing that, we see the basic syntax is HCL file and a YO file. So HCL file is nopcpu.hcl, and I'm going to run it on nops.yo. So what do you, any guesses as to what should happen? Yeah.
It'll output the output like every cycle.
Okay. Yeah, so we'll get output from every cycle. Let's see.
Never set the stat to not
A-OK. Yes, so we set the stat to stat A-OK, which says, keep going, I have more instructions to run or more work to do. We didn't ever say to halt. There's a timeout by default, so we get a timeout message at the end. But it just keeps running. So, which is as expected if you thought about what that stat signal did. So it just kept running because we aren't actually looking at the instruction. We're just always saying, keep going, keep going. The PC got all the way up to hex 2710. And we had the values of the register file, the values of all the registers we declared, and also the contents of memory. Note that when I'm output showing the contents of memory, we just don't output things which were initially zeros, which is everything that wasn't defined in the .yo file. So everything not shown is initially zeros, but then we have address 0, 0 is 10, address 0, 1 is 10, 10 hex, that is, so 16. Okay, that is the nop instruction. But we got into this space in memory, which was all zeros, all halts, but our processor doesn't know what halt is, so we just kept going. So any questions on anything I showed here so far? Any part of this output beyond the bug which is fixed of having two timed out messages?
the YD6 or how does the simulator or whatever handle if the PC gets bigger than the amount of memory we have?
So the question is, what happens if the PC gets bigger than the amount of memory we have? So the simulator does something different than what we do. So in our processor, the instruction memory HCLRS implements handles all 2 to the 64 possible addresses. If you read from an uninitialized address, it's 0. If you try to write to all the memory, the simulator might run out of space. And our PC input is 64 bits, so there's no way of having it be too big. And you have to get it down to 64 bits, so you could have a PC register which is 80 bits, for example. But if you try to send that to the instruction memory, it would say, sorry, you're sending me too big a value, you need to make it big smaller. But the textbook does something where they have an invalid address error. We're just not going to do that. We're just going to say all the addresses are valid. Somehow our memory is actually 2 to the 64 bits. A notable thing is that we see this output from our simulator, where it says the PC was something, that means the input to the instruction memory, and to help you debug things, it shows you, oh, here's the address of what I actually loaded. I believe, see that? Yeah, we can see that here. So it says the PC was this value, that means that's what the instruction memory got as input, and it shows you the decoded instruction. That doesn't mean you're implementing the instruction correctly, this is just to help you debug. We could just show you the raw output of the instruction memory, but you probably prefer having the actual decoded instruction. Okay, so let's say we want to implement HOLT. So what we want to do is we want to set the stat signal to stat AOK if it's a NOP, the stat HOLT if it's a HOLT, and we're going to have this third code for stat we're going to use, which is stat INS for invalid instruction. And we're just going to choose that based on the opcode. So we have a mux here. So what is a mux going to look like in our text-based representation? So we're going to use something where our book calls a case expression. I'm going to typically call these a mux. And we have a bunch of conditions, colon, possible values. So here, we're saying our result wire has the value if x equals 5, 1. If x is in 0 or 6, if x is either 0 or 6, 2. If x is greater than 2, 3, and otherwise 4. 1 is just true. And these are evaluated in order. So if x is 5, we get 1, even though 5 is greater than 2, because we just don't get to x greater than 2. And being in order will make things more convenient. A rule we have in HCLRS that's new this semester, so if you talk to students from last semester, they might assume it would work, is that all case expressions in our HCL variant must have a default case at the end. This is chosen because we think this will avoid many subtle errors that people have had. Yes?
Are case expressions the only place where there's sequential evaluation?
Are case expressions the only place where the sequential evaluation? Essentially, yes. Okay. So that's how we're going to implement our extract opcode and the corresponding mux. So because we have these nice full-featured things where you can like say, if the opcode thing equals whatever the opcode for NOP is, we don't need to actually write that extract opcode logic. That's being done for us. So this is an abstraction which represents both the extract opcode and the actual mux itself. But we do need to actually like figure out how to take i10 bytes, which remember is 10 bytes from the instruction memory, and turn that into just the opcode. So we need to get the subset of the bits that matter, and the way we're going to do that is with this operator. This is a way of saying, I want bits 2 through 9, including 2, excluding 9. And we treat values and wires as numbers. When they're read from memory, it's a little endian, so a 10-byte little endian number. and the least significant bit of that number is zero. So this really, really confuses people when they think about YAD6 instruction encoding. So I'm going to try to go pretty carefully over this. So we have i10 bytes is 10 bytes for memory. The bytes include the instruction. It's a little endian order integer. So the first byte, where the opcode is in the least significant byte of this integer. So that's typically where we want to be looking. So it has the lowest numbered bits. So for example, if we have a push instruction, we have A, which is the opcode we want to get, F is the first byte. 2F is the second byte. That's what we have in memory. And if we look at this as a little endian two-byte number, then AF goes at the bottom. The first byte goes at the bottom of the as the least significant bits of the number. Oh. That probably just can't be fixed. So it's the least significant byte of the number. So that's what we have at the bottom, which means the opcode is not bit zero. It's bit 4 through 8. And the register number RA is not bit 8, it's bit 12 through 16. And when we have treated as a 10 byte number, we just have some stuff in front of here. It doesn't change the numbers of these first bytes of the instruction. So any questions on this? Yes.
Aren't they zero indexed? Would it be
Are the bits zero indexed? Yes. So when I say 4 through 8, I mean with this syntax, where 4 is inclusive, the 8 is exclusive. So this means that the first byte when you see our table, that's bits 0 through 7. But the least significant part of that, because this is not the whole number being written out in a natural order, it's the bytes written out separately. And each byte is written out so the leftmost part is most significant, because it's English, and we expect that. Probably would not like it if the textbook authors had flipped that around, which they could have. So this means our function code is bits 0 through 4, 0 inclusive, 4 exclusive. Our opcode is bits 4 through 8, the most significant 4 bits of byte 0. Then RA is bits 12 through 16 exclusive, the most significant 4 bits of byte 1. So byte 1 is 8 through 16. It's the most significant 4 bits of that. And RB is bytes 8 through 12, the least significant 4 bits of byte 1. So any questions on this? Okay, so hopefully you'll remember this. Yes, one of the things people find most confusing in this class for some reason. Because endianness always gets people. So hopefully you'll remember this, and obviously you can look this up when you're actually writing HCL code. Yes? Okay, so the rule is that the first byte is bits 0 through 8. That's the least significant byte because we treat it as a little endian number. The opcode, because it's leftmost in the right, what you've written as the first byte, is the most significant part of that. Because it's, say, the hex is 4-0, that means 4 is most significant because English rewrite the most significant part of the byte first. So the most significant bits are the higher numbered ones, because we number bits, says the least significant is 0. So it's 4 through 8 for the opcode. And 0 through 4 is, in fact, the function code, the where the condition code or add, subtract, XOR, etc. is. And similarly, for our register numbers, the register numbers are in the second byte, which is bits 8 through 16, but we've written that byte on this diagram with the most significant part leftmost. So the most significant part is the higher part of that, higher numbered part of that byte, 12 bits 12 through 16 is RA. And therefore, the rest of the byte is 8 through 12, that's RB. Any other questions? Okay, so now we know how to extract the opcode using this operator. It's bits 4 through 8. So what our stat logic is going to look like is we're going to have one of these case expressions. We're going to say if it's equal to NOP, which is a predefined constant, so it's equal to 1, is what that constant is, but we just have a predefined constant for that, because again, we assume you're building a y86 processor. We don't want you to spend all your time writing out, looking up what is IRMOVEQ's opcode. You don't need to do that. It's just going to be there. So this is, NOP is a predefined constant for, so NOP is just equal, this is 1 and this is 0. Just another way of writing that. We could have written equals 1 equals 0. Okay. And if we in fact implement this CPU, so have a copy of it here. And if we make, and if we do our NOP halt CPU on our previous nops.yo, which remember had 5 nops and then nothing, but in fact, the rest of memory is filled with zeros. What is zeros? It's a halt instruction. So we'll run that, and we'll load a halt instruction, and after 6 cycles, we'll stop. Yes?
Back to the slide, what does the stat inst?
Stat inst means says invalid instruction. So if I have, say, a YO file with some instruction we don't implement, let's say this one, it has an IRMOVEQ. We don't implement that, and so we're going to stat inst. If I run our CPU on that file, I get the simulator stops and it tells me invalid instructions. So the invalid instruction status code is like halt, but it gives a message saying invalid instruction. So this is now up to the level of complexity of the CPUs we showed before. We can do something similar to, for example, implement jump. So this is the jump CPU you saw earlier. We needed to set the dest. So the dest, we just need to know it's part of the output of the instruction memory. So we just grab the 64 bits where the destination is in our instruction encoding. Since we read the whole thing as a little endian number into i10 bytes and we're getting a subset as a little endian number, we don't have to worry about endianness. That's why our simulator chooses little endian. And we have a mux here where we set what we call valp, which we had to declare. So we're doing something here where I'm saying, I'm declaring something called dest as a wire. I'm declaring something called iCode as a wire. I'm declaring something called valp as a wire. And rather than writing, bits 4 through 8 over and over again, I'm saying iCode is the name of a wire that is this wire here, and it's bits 4 through 8 of i10 bytes, and I'm just using that down here. And similarly, I'm saying dest, it's bits 8 through 72, and I'm just using that down here. And valp is a 64-bit value, which is this value here. I'm calling it valp because that's what our textbook ends up calling it, not because it's a good name. And I have this mux here where I set the value based on that. If the iCode is a nop, I set it to PC plus one. If the iCode is a jump, which the constant is JXX, because remember, all the kinds of jumps have the same top four bits. I set it to dest, and I need to have a default case, so I've chosen to use a default case where I put this value like this. This is an arbitrary choice, but it has the advantage of showing up really nicely on my output to tell me, huh, you got something you didn't expect, which I would recommend. You can just put zero if you like, but I recommend a value like this. So if you see my register contains the value bad, 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 you know, oh, probably it's that mux there that's doing that. And I have similar logic for dealing with my stack. Yes?
Syntax question. Up there, when we declare the wires, can we declare all three in the same line?
Question is, could you have declared all three wires in the same line? Yes. Yes, you could have. Okay. So I have my not jump CPU. And similarly for this, I can run this on some file with nops and jumps. So I have a YS file with nops and jumps. I have a YS file with nops and jumps. So I'm going to assemble that into a Yo file. And then I'm going to run jump CPU on that file. And I will scroll through this output. So first we load a nop, then we load a jump, which has an address, which goes to address 13, so the next PC we have is 13, then the next PC we have is OXA, because that's where our jump goes to, then we have a jump to address 1C, and that's in fact our next PC, which is a nop, and then another nop after that, one and plus that, and then a halt. And we get our final output. Any questions? Yeah.
Is there a way to output like a diagram that corresponds to the processor?
The question is there a way to output a diagram that corresponds to the processor? No, besides doing it by hand. That is a more difficult problem than I would like it to be. It is a commonly requested feature. Oh, also I should note, this is what our notjump.io looks like. So it still has the bytes written out, but it's each byte's value as two hex digits in order from lowest to highest memory address, which maybe is not what you expected, but that's the format they use. Okay, so let's talk a bit more formally about differences from the book. So the book, they declare things with bool or int. We just always use wire. So we use wire, we specify how wide the wire is. The book uses particular names like valc, and in their HCL, you have to choose your names based on the widths of wires you want. We don't have that restriction. So if you don't like the name valc, you never have to use it. You can just write, you can write a name that makes more sense to you, like ALU result. Okay. Another difference is in the book, they have some more built-in components. So in the book, like most of the ALU is provided to the students, we're going to have you write it. You're going to write it with the mux. It's not hard. But we don't have as much fixed functionality as the book, even though we have a lot. Okay, so let's talk a bit about some of the things I showed you earlier and how they actually work in HTLRS in a bit more detail. So we have register banks. So this is the general syntax for register banks. We have our input and output letter. The input letter must be lowercase. And for each register we declare, in this example, foo and bar, we'll have an input signal of the lowercase letter underscore foo and underscore bar. And we'll have an output signal with the uppercase letter, which in this case is y, underscore foo, underscore bar. That will be the output of the register. The input will be the value at the next clock cycle. And each register has a width. This is the how many bits it has. You have to specify that. There's no default. And it has a default value, which is the value it's going to have when your processor starts. When we talk about pipelining, we'll learn there's another way this is going to be used. But for now, it's just when the processor starts. There's some other signals, which we'll talk more about when we talk about pipelining, stall and bubble, which affect all the registers in this set of registers. That's why we have what we're calling register banks, this set of related registers. For now, all your processors pretty much are just going to have a PC register that you declare and registers for the condition codes SF and ZF. And that's it. And wires. So I showed you what wire declarations look like. So we declare wires. We can have multiple ones in a line separated by commas. You can do them one per line. You have a wire name and a wire width. The width is mandatory. You have to specify it. You cannot initialize a wire when you declare it. You have to set it elsewhere. And a wire, you can think of representing a wire in a circuit. It needs to have something connected to it. You can't just have a floating wire that doesn't make sense. So you can have something connected to it once and have its value go to multiple places or no place. There's some implicit wires. So there's some wires we declare for you, which are for built-in components. One example is the stat wire. That's the input to this special component that's pre-declared for you. It has a width. We just haven't told you what it is. And assignment, you should think of as connecting wires, not as doing assignment. We'll talk about order in a second, and it's much more like connecting things. So here, I have two programs. I've done things in a different order. Here, I'm reading from ValP, and I have my assignment down here. That is perfectly fine. Just like if we connect wires in a circuit, the values will propagate based on how the wires are connected, not based on what order you specified the wires in or whether one wire is left more on the page than the other. So in the same way, the order doesn't matter. The values are just going to propagate down the wires until we get to the endpoints, which are things like the input to our PC register and the input to our stat register. So we're going to do that, and when we've propagated the values as far as they go, we declare the cycle's over and start the next cycle. That's what our simulator is doing. So it doesn't care about the order in which you connect wires, it just cares about what's connected to what.
Do you have to declare a wire before you reference it in the file then?
Do you have to declare a wire before you reference it? I don't think so, but I'm not actually sure. I probably should know since I wrote HCLRS, but I don't think you do. I would recommend doing so.
Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah, I don't think you do. Then. Yeah, I don't think you do. But I would strongly recommend doing so. Because usually what you want to do is declare all the wires you're using and then use them. But I don't think you do. So the order doesn't matter. Either the wire is connected to something and it's going to get a value propagated to it, or it's not. Doesn't matter when it is. So we talked about widths. So widths and wires. You can't stick a wide value into a small wire. No. Or vice versa. So if you have a value with a width, which is values on wires have widths, you can't change them. So like if you want to stick a small value from a big wire, you need to specify the subset of bits you want. We're not going to choose them for you. And this applies in other places. There's other places, like if you try to compare two values of different widths, you will get an error saying, wait a moment, why are you comparing a 64-bit value to a 4-bit number, 4-bit opcode? That doesn't make any sense. This should hopefully help you catch errors, because usually that means you shouldn't be doing that. If you really want to do it, you can subset the value and figure out how to make that work. So any questions about wires and width agreement? Okay, and I guess something I should mention about width is that constants have widths sometimes. So this constant is no width. So you can use it with any width wire, it will just resize. If you have a binary constant, which you can write like 0, this is 10 in binary, this is 4 width 4. So that you can assign to a 4 wide wire, but not a 5 wide wire. That will be an error. And the built-in constants, for example, NOP is 4 bits wide, because it's supposed to be an opcode. Okay, so let's talk a bit about the built-in components of the processor. So we mentioned STAT before. So this is the hardwired STAT register whose input signal is just called uppercase S STAT. And it has some possible values. So we saw three of them. If you read the HLS write-up, there's this block of like what constants are declared. So you can see there's some other possible values. Pretty much all of them that aren't mentioned are just things which act like invalid instruction. They will halt the processor with an error, halt the simulator with an error. They just a different error. This thing must be set because the simulator has to have an idea of knowing whether it should keep going or not. The other component which we saw was the instruction memory. So you have an input wire, the PC, which is 64 bits wide. So this is 64-bit wide input. And when you put something on that, out in the same cycle on the signal i10 bytes, you will get 10 bytes from that address. And we talked earlier about how you determine which bits are the bits you care about in the instruction. And if you have a less than 10 byte instruction, you're still going to be reading 10 bytes. You don't have an option not to do that. You're just not going to use all the bits. So we have a register file. So the register file is a component you don't have to build. You technically have the components to do so. Like you could make a register bank with RAX, RBX, RCX, and then have a whole bunch of muxes to decide which ones to set and all that. You could build a register file, but we're going to supply one for you. And you must use it because you noticed our output includes all these register values. We're going to use that like to grade your processor. So, you know, we better set those values or else we'll think, wow, that doesn't do the right thing. RAX isn't set and I moved something into it. So our built-in register file has inputs which correspond to the inputs you see in like diagrams we've shown for the register file. So we have register number inputs, which for source register numbers and destination register numbers. And these just have fixed names. If you need to look up the names, the HCLRS write-up linked off the website is where you should do so. Like I understand you might not memorize these names. So these are 4-bit inputs because register numbers are 4 bits. So you put a value on reg source A, and you will get that corresponding value output on reg output A, the value of whatever register number you sent. So if you sent register number 0, that's RAX, you'll get the value of RAX on reg output A in the same clock cycle. And reg source B and reg output B work the same way. We also have two destination register numbers. So if you put a value on reg desti, you will get, at the end of the clock cycle, whatever value is on reg input E will be stored in that register. So if I set reg input E to 42 and set reg desti to 0, that means at the end of the clock cycle, 42 will be stored into RAX. So RAX is register 0. And dest M and input M work the same way. And like we described earlier, the way we're going to not do any writing or reading is we're going to supply reg none is the constant, which is 15, the special register number for the one we don't use. When you're writing, this will just not do a write. When you're reading, this will put 0 on the output because, well, there has to be a value there, or else the processor doesn't know what to do. So unlike the components we've seen before, the register file is not mandatory. If you don't set reg source A and don't use reg output A, that's fine. If you don't set reg source B and don't use reg output B, that's fine. Same with the inputs. As long as you don't like try to half use the component, it's just not going to be there. So for example, let's say we wanted to do add. Example we saw earlier. So we'd set reg source A and reg source B to be the appropriate part of the instruction we extracted earlier. And then we'd set reg input E and reg dest E to be the destination register and its new value. Any questions about what this is doing? Yeah.
You're using normal arithmetic there, but you also said that we're implementing an ALU. Are we just doing that?
So a question is, what does implementing an ALU mean? So we support normal arithmetic, and including subtraction and OR. So implementing an ALU is just implementing the mux that chooses between them. But that is actually done for people in the text author's implementation. Okay. So the last thing I'd like to talk about is the data memory. So the data memory we're going to use for things like rmoveq, mrmoveq, push, pop, and so on. And like the one we described, it has this read-enable and write-enable signal because it supports both reading and writing. And you need to decide which one or ones you're doing. So there's an input called memReadBit and memWriteBit that correspond to the read and write enable signals. They're 1-bit inputs. 0 means no, 1 means yes. There's also an address input and an input value. So mem underscore input is the value to write. If you aren't writing a value, you shouldn't be using it. Mem underscore adder is the address to read to or read from or write to. And mem output is the value we just read. So these are named from the perspective of the data memory, not from yours perspective. And if you don't remember, you should look up in the HGRLS write-up what they mean, you know, rather than worrying a lot about memorizing. So if you're reading, you'll set the address to the address you want to read. You'll set the read bit to true, the write bit to false, and just use the output of the data memory. And you'll get that value in the same cycle. If you're writing, you'll set the address, you'll set the input, you'll set the write bit, and at the end of the cycle, you'll get that value updated in the memory. Any questions about any of these built-in components? Okay, so I'd like to talk about some other features we have.
HRS.
So HRS has some support for debugging, which I strongly recommend using. So one of these features is the minus D or dash dash debug flag. And what that does, I'll probably do this way, is it shows you more about what's going on. So we have here, we can see we have I10 bytes was set to this value because we read 10 bytes from memory at PC. So we have a description of what happens to all the built-in components. So this case, we're just using the instruction memory. If we were using the data memory and we were reading, it would say reading from some address, some value. So you know that happened. And we also have the values of every single wire in a table in alphabetical order at the end of each cycle. So if you want to know what's going on because your processor isn't doing the right thing, I recommend looking at this output, especially if you can construct a .ys file, which like is a minimal example of your processor doing something wrong. And this is in addition to the output we have up here, which like shows you the register value, PC register value in this case, and the values in memory and all the register file values. So another feature we have for debugging is there's a dash I flag for interactive. And what that does is it stops after every cycle. It says, press enter to continue. So I can go cycle by cycle that way if I want to. And I can, of course, combine that with the -d flag. And finally, there is a quiet mode, which is dash Q or dash dash quiet. Oh, yeah. I'm not even showing you that. Which is like this. So it only shows the final output. So if you just want to quickly check, does it do the right thing on this file, you can do that. And you can see how many cycles it ran, did it halt, or did it get like an invalid instruction error, and what the final values of the registers were. So what we have is, so our fundamental component is we have a bunch of wires. So we have wires that we explicitly declare, which were kind of like variables, but the assignment didn't work that way. We just had something connected to the wire in what looked like an assignment, but all we cared about is that it was connected somewhere. If it was connected somewhere, the value would propagate there every cycle. And we had built-in components, and all the built-in components were controlled or used by wires. They had some wires which were input wires, which we had to connect a value to, and that value would be used every cycle by the component to decide what to do. So for the instruction memory, it would every cycle it would look at the value on the PC wire and use that to read memory. We had output wires, which were connected from these components, like the output of the instruction memory was the value of the 10 bytes at the address we read. And we connected those wires somewhere, possibly taking subsets of the bits in order to actually do useful operations. We had muxes. And in muxes, we had a bunch of tests which were in order. So it was as if we checked the first test one. If it's true, we output value one. We check test two. If it's true, we output value two. And you had to have a default, which was always true, which I'm writing with one colon here. And the idea of me calling these muxes is that this is exactly what will translate every mux plus the logic to figure out how to like convert the opcode so the mux understands what to do for it. So that will be a test. Typically, the test is going to be iCode, where iCode is a wire set from the opcode, equals some instruction name, do something, and so on. We had register banks. So register banks had this convention where we have two letters. One is the input letter, which is always lowercase and first. And that was the prefix for all the input signals to the register, which are the values it would take next cycle. And we had an output letter, which has the output of the register, which is the current value of the register. That's the prefix for those signals. And our register banks could have multiple registers in them. Right now, the only time you'll be doing that soon is with the condition codes, because you'll have SF and ZF, and you'll probably want them as separate registers, that you could like have one 2-bit register that's both of them, but that seems inconvenient. And we had some fixed functionality. We had a register file, which had our 15 Y86 registers, whose values are printed out after every cycle by default. And that you must use because that's how we're going to grade your processor. We're going to check if you set the registers correctly in the correct cycles. And we had two read and two write ports. So what we have when we have a pair of either a register number input and an output signal or a register number input and a value input, we call those a port. So the ones where we read a value from the register file, we call a read port. Ones where we write a value to the register file, we call a write port. So we have two read ports and two write ports. And this is because, as we'll find out when we think about, say, an instruction like pop, sometimes we need to write to register values. And if you think about an instruction like add, we sometimes need to read to register values. And we want to execute every instruction in one cycle. So that's what we need in our processor. So that's why we have that register file. In a real processor, you might have a register file that has different numbers of read and write ports. And we also have memories. And we have a separate data and instruction memory. So in our simulator, these actually both access the same actual memory. So if you write a value to the data memory and then read that same address from the instruction memory, you will read that value. So they're actually just like two views of the same memory. And our instruction memory has one, what we call a read port, one way of reading it, and it reads 10 bytes at a time. And our data memory has this switch to switch between reading and writing. It can read a value or write a value, but not both. And we also have a stat register, which is to control our simulator. It's the equivalent of controlling like the power. So it's how we say, I'm done. I got to a state where I want to stop, and the simulator will stop, or I got to a state where something bad happened, I had an instruction I didn't understand, and the simulator will stop and give an error, or to tell the simulator to keep going. You have to set it every clock cycle, because the way the simulator is working is it checks all the signals over the clock cycle, and then decides, okay, I'm done, or I'm not done. Okay, any questions about any of this? Okay, so I mentioned briefly that you'll have to build your own ALU. So this is what I mean by that. So like all the operations are there, but the textbook actually assumed that they provided this sort of logic. And this is one way you could do it. And generally, our textbook makes some design choices. For example, in our textbook, when they're reading a value from memory and writing it to a register, they always use the port called with an M and not an E in the register file. They always use a normal ALU to add or subtract 8 from RSP when instructions need to do that, like push and pop. Versus, say, having a separate adding thing that's a different, not in the same part of the text description. You do not have to do this. We're going to say you need to implement these instructions, and it needs to be a single cycle processor. Or later on, it used to be a pipeline five-stage processor that has particular timing. But we're just going to say you need to execute instructions with this timing. And if you do that and you set the values and registers in memory, we don't care how you do it. So if you don't like what the textbook has chosen to do, you think it's more convenient to have some separate piece of code that adds 8, that's fine. And a final note. So we have something called YIS, which is the reference simulator. So I have my not jump here, and I run YIS on it, and it tells me stopped in 7 steps at PC equals 0x1e. And you can see that's what happened. It's not equivalent to what happened here, because we didn't implement some logic for halt. But this tells you what a processor, a y86 processor, is supposed to do. So it has a list of the changes to registers in cases where that happens. So if I run it on one of our supplied files, which actually changes registers, we can see it says RCX was initially 0. Now it's a negative number. RDX was initially 0, now it's this, and so on. It says it stopped in 8 steps, that's the PC. It status HLT, so that was the stat signal. And it also shows you the condition codes. So this is ZF, this is SF, this is OF, which we don't require you to implement. And it also would show you changes to memory if we ran it on, say, a file which changes memory, which is probably this one. It will show you this memory address changed to this value. So you can use this to figure out what was it supposed to do without hand simulating the assembly. Okay, so any questions on HCL? Right, I am not displaying the same thing. Okay, now I am. Okay, so let's go to one last brief topic. So we started off with this CPU, this move to register CPU. So we have one other move instruction we could talk about, so let's add that to this in our last 5 minutes. So you just want to add our last move instruction, which is RM move queue from a register to another register. So what are we going to need to do? What are things I'm going to need to change to do that here? So this is how you should think about the process. I need to add this extra instruction, and maybe I have a text-based description of this, but what parts need to actually change? So what's something which we're doing here that we should not be doing for, which we need to do for our move queue that we're not doing yet? Yeah.
Have the destination possibly be data memory.
So have the destination be data memory. So what does that change in the picture? Mm-hmm. So this mux here needs to change?
There might need to be something after it.
Okay, so you think we need to change this input. So this is a point which is a big point of confusion, which is that, you know, we imagine we need to change the input to the register file. But if you remember how our register file works, that the way we don't write or read is by specifying a different register number. So we won't actually do anything to the value. So we could specify a different value to that mux, to this mux here, but there's no value that's correct unless we like make sure we're forwarding the value we just read from the same register. So what we'll most likely do is add an input to the destination register number to achieve that effect, rather than like trying to forward the value that the register already had to overwrite the same value. So that's one thing we need to add. We need to make sure the destination is not a register. We need to add to our mux to specify the register number to support that. Anything else we need to add here? So what else does the RM move queue instruction do besides not write to a register? Yeah?
Reads from a register, writes to memory.
So it writes to memory. So it reads from a register. Let's go with that step by step. So it reads from a register. It reads from source B, and we're already doing that. So it reads from RB, we're already doing that, so that's taken care of. And it writes to memory, so how do we write to memory? So first, we had a signal I didn't draw on this thing, which is whether to read, and we also have one whether to write. So we better actually connect those. So we're gonna have a signal about whether we write that's connected based on the opcode. And we also need to take a second step of actually having an input to the data input. We have an address input, which has a value. And if you look carefully, it's actually the right value because of how our instruction set is designed to be easier to implement. But we need a data input. Yeah. And so that's the components we need. So there's other things the instruction needs to do. So it needs to, for example, add 10 to the PC. But we already have that functionality. We're going to need to change our code, which implements this mux. We're going to have like iCode equals MR move queue. We're going to need to add iCode equals RM move queue to handle that case. but we don't need to add a mux to it, but we're going to still change our corresponding HCL code. But we're going to have to add mem input equals something. We're going to have to add something to mem read bit and mem write bit to set them correctly based on the opcode. We're going to have a mux to do that. One case is zero if we're not reading, otherwise one, and so on. Okay, so that's what I have for today. So next time we'll talk, Samira will talk more about implementing processors and all the other instructions we didn't get to, including the really complicated ones like pop.